This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This hour, changes in U.S. military and political tactics in Iraq. Yesterday, in Baghdad, American forces unleashed attack helicopters and AC-130 gunships, the first use of U.S. air power in the Iraqi capital since President Bush announced an end to major combat operations. At the same time, in Washington, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, Ambassador Paul Bremer, met with senior officials at the White House to work out a way to accelerate a transfer of authority. Amid mounting violence and casualties, skittish allies, slipping approval ratings, and a CIA warning of receding Iraqi support, the Bush administration is changing course. This hour, we'll try to figure out why, what the new plans are, and whether these changes signal an effort to pull American troops out of Iraq more quickly than had been projected. And we will begin in Baghdad, where a fresh round of American attacks is underway tonight. NPR's Ivan Watson joins us from the Iraqi capital. And thanks very much, Ivan.
Good afternoon, Neil.
What can you tell us about what's happening in Baghdad tonight?
Well, we're hearing periodic explosions echoing through the city. This is the third straight night of these kind of sounds, and it seems like it's the second night of what's being called Operation Iron Hammer. The U.S. military is claiming responsibility for these explosions. Last night, the sounds that we were hearing in the distance were attributed to an AC-130 gunship that was used, as well as Bradley fighting vehicles, to attack what appeared to have been an empty warehouse that I visited this morning. And there were also some Apache helicopters that were conducting an operation to the west of the city, chasing down a van of suspected insurgents who have been blamed for firing mortars in the Iraqi capital. This comes as there are periodic mortar attacks in Baghdad, directed against the so-called Green Zone. This is the headquarters of the U.S. civil administration here, of the U.S. military. In fact, during a press briefing today at the convention center where the U.S. civil administration frequently speaks to the press, there was a loud explosion there that was not explained that did shake that building. Mm. It's become part of everyday life here. Mm.
Now, as you just noted in that comment, the factory that was hit last night was empty. You and others reported that American soldiers warned the workers there that an attack was underway, which if insurgents were meeting there, might have undermined the effect. Is there any guess as to whether this is all for show, for effect, or whether this is actionable intelligence pinpointing Iraqi insurgency targets?
Well, we can't really tell. We definitely know that morale is not at its highest right now among American troops, and even among some of the American officials. There is an undeniable issue here of security, of this fierce resistance that we're seeing from the insurgency in Iraq, and it's definitely dealt some major blows to what's being called the coalition here. The operation that was announced last night, it came just hours after a spectacular bombing in the southern town of Nasiriyah, which killed and injured dozens of Italian soldiers, as well as Iraqi civilian bystanders. It's anybody's guess whether this is for show. The fact of the matter is that U.S. officials, the commander of U.S. forces here in Baghdad, has announced he expects more resistance attacks over the next 1 to 2 months, that even though they're trying to take the offensive right now, the U.S. military, this does not preclude the possibility that there will continue to be fierce resistance. In fact, there was a U.S. soldier reported killed yesterday here in the Iraqi capital.
Trying to take the battle to the enemy. Is that the description of Operation, what's it being called, Iron Hammer?
Yes, it is. And today, a U.S. military spokesman was repeating that expect to see more of these types of attacks, more of the U.S. military taking this offensive here in Baghdad. We've seen air power used in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit within the past week and a half. We've seen airstrikes used against targets in the western town of Fallujah. And it does seem to be that the military is being called in to try to take the offensive right now. But there was also a press briefing given by the commander of U.S. forces in this region, Central Command. This was out of Florida, mm-hmm. out of the headquarters, General John Abizade. And he said that he expects there perhaps are 5,000 resistance fighters in Iraq. This includes Iraqis and ordinary and foreign fighters, which are said to have crossed the border into Iraq. Among the people that I talked to, I do have to say I've been away from the country for a week, for a month and a half, came back recently, and I did find a palpable change, a lot more frustration, anger, disillusionment in the U.S. occupation just over the course of the past 2 months, and that's coming along with the disastrous suicide bombings that have really scared a lot of Iraqis in Baghdad and throughout the country.
Are those attacks, though, and as you point out, Iraqis are the victims more often than anybody else. Are those attacks driving Iraqis into the arms of the coalition? Help us or we're going to help you? Or are they beginning to cause doubt, as that leaked CIA analysis has suggested, and causing Iraqis to doubt in the ultimate victory of the coalition and maybe siding more with the insurgents?
This is difficult to quantify. There is definitely real anger at the insurgents for the suicide bombings. There were reports that people were volunteering to join the Iraqi police, especially after a series of bomb attacks against the police stations, a number of police stations, all in the same day at the end of October here in Baghdad. But that does not mean that people are saying they support the U.S. more. In fact, I've been out in the streets here talking to people, more and more, especially young Iraqis, telling me that they think the U.S. Is a failure here, that not only that 2 months ago they were not happy with the U.S., with what the U.S. had done, and they'd seen very little progress since then over the course of the past 2 months. One woman I did speak with, she did support the talk of a U.S. crackdown on the insurgents. This was today. She said her children were panicking when they were hearing the explosions coming from the AC-130 gunship last night. Her children were panicking. She was opening windows for fear that the explosions could blast in the glass in her house. But at the same time, she said, somebody needs to strike back at these insurgents. But overall, I would say the impression I've gotten is people may not be supporting these so-called terrorists. People are calling them terrorists and denouncing the suicide attacks, but that is not putting them into the arms of the U.S. occupation. I'm not hearing that.
NPR's Ivan Watson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Ivan Watson joining us by satellite telephone from Baghdad. Joining us here in Studio 3A is retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Gary Anderson, and always good to have you on the program. Thanks
Hi,
very
Neil.
Much for coming in. From what you're seeing coming out of Baghdad in the last couple of 3 days, is this an important change in tactics we're seeing there, this much more aggressive American response?
Yeah, I think that an aggressive response is obviously warranted. The problem you have, I think, when you use gunships and so forth, is that my sensing is that when you want to, if you've got an area where you think guerrillas are operating out of or insurgents, this is my own personal opinion, but I my tendency is to cordon it off. Go in, try to take it down physically, and get prisoners. Use of ground troops. The reason I say that is because if you get prisoners, then you've got intelligence information, and if you use bombs, you have a tendency to get a hole in the ground and not much more.
Some have compared these tactics, precision weaponry and very high-powered modern weaponry against specific targets, to Israeli tactics against some Palestinian forces. Does that comparison seem apt to you?
Well, it's hard for me to tell because I don't know what the target was or what the target profile was. I'd recommend against that. I'll tell you what I think I would tend to do is if you've got a factory that a mortar was fired out of, I'd go to the guy that owns the factory or whoever and I'd say, okay, look, you are now a soup kitchen. You know, we're gonna put you to work on a public action project. No, by the way, you're gonna pay for it. And you know, force him to pay the price. But if in fact he's been responsible for some of that, and you catch him, that's fine. You can deal with him as appropriate.
That would address one of the great risks of high intensity military operations, particularly in an urban environment, which is collateral damage. You risk alienating an awful lot of Iraqis.
Yeah, I think that you need to be seen as being as surgical as you possibly can in your response to anything that you do. And I think this is, again, where I think it's very important, and you talk about change of strategy. We really need to accelerate the turnover of this to Iraqi police and the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, which is the paramilitary militia that they're trying to form, which is apparently getting some good recruiting support, and I think that's the really important thing is that we just don't know if you're in an area, if you're in a neighborhood where there are Yemenis or Egyptians or Saudis operating, we won't know the difference because we just don't pick up the subtleties of the language. We don't know who the former Baathists are and so forth. The locals do. Mm. And I think that's why it's so important to saturate these areas with local security forces as soon as practicable. Not push them out there before they're ready, but as soon as they're ready to go out there and take this on themselves and put the United States more in the reaction force mode and get U.S. Troops a little bit less visible on the street, because nobody wants to see foreign troops continuously patrolling their capital.
Some have referred to this as Iraqification. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a question from Patrick, who's on the line with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Colonel.
Hi.
I'm a ex-Marine. I fought in Vietnam, and I was thinking about how low our morale was over there. And the morale was low because we really didn't believe in what we were doing. And I think the same thing is happening now. I think the troops' morale is down because a lot of them just don't believe in what the administration said why we're there. So it's helpful to the troops to go out on a campaign and do some fighting and shoot their rifles, and it's good to go out and kick some butt, but it doesn't change the fact that in the quiet of the night or when they're walking quietly through a town, they're asking themselves, what the heck am I doing here? I don't believe my life is worth losing here for reasons that I can't explain to my loved ones. So that's the campaign I'd like to see, is this administration to try and sell not the American people, but the troops, to help them not feel so doubting of the cause.
Colonel Anderson?
Yeah, Pat, just one thing. Unless you were court-martialed or thrown out, you're a former Marine, not an ex-Marine.
Thank you, Colonel.
Let me address that. I think that one of the things that should be really important right now is for our folks to be out mentoring these new Iraqi security forces. You can't throw them out in the street on their own. They need to be helped along. I think probably one of the most useful things you can do. We had the combined action program in Vietnam, which was very successful, and we've had a long history of training constabularies. And that means your guys are out on the street helping and training and mentoring until they're ready to go off on their own. I think that, in my view, I know the Marines that were in the Civil Action Program really enjoyed that, and I think the Army Special Forces guys did the same thing, really felt they were making a contribution, because then you see the turnover of control to the local forces.
But, Colonel, what do you think about the morale over there? Do you think the Marines are really believing what the administration said? Do you think they're really?
Well, we're going to have to get to Patrick's question when we come back from a break, and we'll hang on, Patrick. We'll bring you back after we return from a short break. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-989-8255. We're also, in a few minutes' time, going to be start addressing some of the political changes in Baghdad. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a few minutes, we'll start to talk about some of the political changes the U.S. appears to want to get underway in Baghdad. At the moment, we're talking about a shift in U.S. military tactics in Iraq. Our guest is retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Gary Anderson. On the line with us from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Patrick, who, Patrick, just before the break, you were asking Colonel Anderson to respond to your question about the morale of U.S. soldiers. I'm not sure any Marines are right there at the moment, but U.S. soldiers in Iraq and in Baghdad in specific and Iraq in general.
Yeah, let me address that. You're right, Neil. There are no Marines in country right now, other than maybe some people on the joint staffs and so forth, but they are preparing another rotation to go back as part of this new troop rotation. And I spent last week with a number of soldiers and Marine commanders who are sort of a lessons learned conference, who are preparing to go back, and they say that universally their folks are looking forward to getting back into the situation. This is what Marines and soldiers have a tendency to want to do. Particularly the Marines, you know, when they go out on normal deployments, they sit aboard ship a lot, and it's not real exciting. So I can't speak for the Army and country right now, but when I was there the last time, I found morale, particularly in the 1st Marine Division or 1st Armored Division, fairly high. That was then. This is now. I can't speak for that, but I think soldiers and Marines like to do what they're trained to do. I think the folks that I've talked to that are in Afghanistan say that the worst morale in Afghanistan is the folks that are having to guard Bagram Air Base because they can't get out and do anything, and they that seems to bother them. So I'm not too concerned about morale at this point in time.
Patrick, I wanted to thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
You betcha.
Okay, bye-bye. Email question from Marilyn in Washington, D.C. On the one hand, the administration says it needs better intelligence in Iraq, implying their intelligence is not currently adequate. On the other hand, they're bombing extensively. Well, they're at least bombing some targets. One wonders whether they're bombing the right targets, she asks.
Yeah, I think that, of course, I have no idea what the target profiles are. That's sort of what it goes back to my comment that I kind of like raids with troops, direct action type raids where you can pick up prisoners and pick up intelligence and things like that. That's your best source of intelligence. But again, I really point to the fact that it's better to do this with Iraqis who are more sensitive to the language and it'll be able to pick out people that don't belong and things like that. And that's, this isn't going to happen overnight. My sensing here is that we're seeing a sort of an interim measure until we can get enough Iraqis on the street to do that.
Let's go to another caller. This is Ulysses, who's in Newport News, Virginia.
Yes, sir. I just had a comment or a question primarily. I'm a veteran of Somalia during the Black Hawk Down incident, and one of the things that I've been noticing, and it's my concern ever in looking at Somalia, was when we change our objective, military objective, from a humanitarian trying to rebuild the country to going after a deed in all of these pieces, band of thieves, per se, that's when we started getting into trouble, and I've been noticing a lot of that going on in Iraq, and I was just wondering, is it just me, or because of my experience, or is there some type of similarity between what's going on in Iraq and what we learn, or if we learn anything from the Somalia incident?
Colonel Anderson, I believe you were in Somalia as well.
Yeah, I was there about the same time, so I think I can I tend to agree with Ulysses. The problem we got into in Somalia was that we kind of cut out some key members. We declared the Haber Gieder and General Adid's folks to be persona non grata and started chasing them down. And culturally in Somalia, you need to have somebody to talk to stop the violence. A little bit different situation here in that the folks, the hardcore guerrillas, the insurgents who are opposing us aren't interested in talking. at this point in time. We know now that Adid's people were in Somalia and they were looking for some way to reopen the dialogue. So right now, the key target for us should be the swing population. The guerrillas are either trying to intimidate or convince the population that they should either go to ground or support them. And that's where the hearts and minds happen. You don't win hearts and minds against the hardcore insurgents. You win it on that swing population that hasn't made its mind up yet.
Ulysses, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, Colonel Anderson, how easy or hard do you think it's going to be for, as we transfer subjects and look ahead to the political situation, but how hard is it going to be to put together a provisional government?
Yeah, you know, Neil, we had a war game a few years ago, and war game is probably a bad word. It was a role-playing exercise where we put together a situation in a mythical country where we tried to do something very similar to this. And we actually had some people from the factions we were portraying doing the role-playing for the factions. And we found it pretty easy to put together a provisional government, an interim government. Found it pretty easy to rebuild the security forces. Building a long-term constitutional mechanism proved to be a lot more difficult. And I think that was essentially because most factions, whether they be sectarian or ethnically based, have a tendency to be exclusionary, where constitutional mechanisms force inclusion and force compromise. So it's a challenge, not an impossible challenge, but I think we're going to find that. I think it'll be a lot easier to put together a provisional government than it will a long-term constitutional mechanism.
Well, they're supposed to have a constitution ready in just about a month now to present the United Nations. That's not going to be easy.
Well, it's not going to be easy, no.
Colonel Anderson, thanks very much as always.
Thank you, Neil.
Retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Gary Anderson was with us here in Studio 3A. As mentioned earlier, the top U.S. administrator in Baghdad, Paul Bremer, met with President Bush in Washington yesterday to talk about ways to transfer power sooner to Iraqis. Bremer refused to disclose any details of the meeting with the president, but the speed at which he was summoned to Washington indicates a sense of urgency about getting the process of Iraqi sovereignty accelerated. Joining us now in Studio 3A is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, and thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
So the meeting yesterday at the White House, and more people were involved than just the president and Ambassador Bremer, but what did they discuss actual strategies to transfer power to Iraqis?
They did. According to Secretary of State Colin Powell, who was part of this, he just recently spoke to reporters at the State Department and said that Bremer came with several ideas, and he got instructions to go back to talk to the Iraqi Governing Council and come up quickly on a plan and agree on some of these ideas. It's still very vague. Some of the things that have been floated around, for instance, is to have elections for a constitutional drafting committee, and in the meantime, setting up some sort of provisional government.
Wait, to draft the constitution that's due at the UN in a month?
There's a couple things. The key is, of course, the sequence of this. Bremer has always said, we want to have a constitution, then we have elections, and then we can transfer sovereignty
to a then legitimate government.
And that's what we're seeing changing. We're seeing the idea of having some provisional authority. And as Condoleezza Rice, a national security advisor, said today, the timetable for the constitution is being extended.
I see.
Now, as for the December 15th deadline, it's a little bit different because that was a deadline for the Iraqi Governing Council to come up with their plan of how they're going to have these, how they're going to draft a constitution and how they're going to have elections. So that timetable still exists, but the question is how long are they going to have to actually get the constitution written, and are they going to have a real government in place before then, which is something the Bush administration had resisted up until now.
So we're seeing reports of proposals that vary from, say, of the 25-member council. Maybe we should boil that down to a 10-member super council that would have greater powers, or even perhaps down to one man who would be in charge of Iraq.
That's right. I mean, the main thing is that we're seeing a lot of frustration with how the Iraqi Governing Council has worked. And I think if you talk to analysts here, that they describe, one person described it to me as it's another false start of this administration. They thought that they could put this together and that this would have enough legitimacy. It hasn't up until now. And there's been a lot of frustration in Washington about the political rivalries, the ethnic rivalries on this council. So now they're going to have to decide what to do. President Bush did say that we're still going to work with this council. I mean, this council was picked by the United States. This is about what they have. But the question is how do you create something new? Do you expand it? And these are all things that Bremer's going to have to make up his mind on when he gets back to Baghdad.
And the idea was not to return to Baghdad with a plan, or at least a public plan, but to work one out with the council so it doesn't look like it's being imposed from Washington.
Exactly. Certainly not a public plan, at least.
Now, we clearly see a sense of increased urgency on the part of the administration. Sure, not only the political side we're talking about, but the military side we were talking about earlier. What is that related to, do you think? Is that simply a function of, they're seeing that things not working and certainly seeing an increase in attacks and American casualties?
I think the security issue is one of the big factors, and the fact that they're not getting the international support that they've had, that the governing council has not found the legitimacy. But also, and I've heard this not only from analysts, but even from people who are affiliated with the Coalition Provisional Authority, that they fear that the election season here in the United States is driving this. That's certainly one big factor. Speculation now that the Bush administration wants to be able to ramp down their operations in Iraq. And one way to do that is to get the political side moving.
Well, that's this week. Last week, the president was talking about the glories of the democracy to come in Iraq and its role as a watershed event in the spread of global freedom. How do those two things jive?
Well, he still does talk about it, and they still say that they haven't set any deadlines and that this doesn't have to do with U.S. election campaign, but that's certainly one of the factors that's pushing them to be more urgent. And again, as I said, the frustration with the Iraqi Governing Council.
Okay, Michelle, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman with us here in Studio 3A. And joining us now by phone from his office in New York is David Phillips, Deputy Director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was formerly an advisor to the State Department on Iraqi reconstruction. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You wrote a commentary today in the LA Times, an op-ed piece, calling for a course correction in U.S. strategy in Iraq, more specifically the establishment of an interim assembly. Tell us a little bit more about that. How would it work?
Summoning Jerry Bremer back to Washington really conveyed a sense of urgency. The Bush administration for a long time has been talking about staying the course. Now they're talking about a course correction. That means coming up with some legitimate form of Iraqi governance that can move this process forward, and in so doing, change the security environment so that coalition troops are not the target that they have been.
We're speaking with David Phillips, a senior fellow and deputy director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Does that mean to you that Michelle was just talking about the frustrations the administration has with the governing council? Is it a failure at this point?
The administration can't label the governing council a failure because the council is its creation, and they've invested a lot of responsibility in the council for stewarding Iraqi governance. I think what needs to happen, and part of the discussions with Bremer yesterday focused on broadening the council, developing some kind of a basic law that would lead to an interim assembly. My own view is that you can do that by including the governing council, adding to it the Iraqi ministers that are working pretty well, and then going to local political and tribal leaders in the 18 provinces and getting them to contribute delegations to the interim assembly. That kind of geographic representation satisfies the Arab Shia demand for a democratic process. Once you get the assembly stood up, they can assign a constitutional committee, move the process forward from there.
Now, there is also a question of, none of this is going to be easy until there is a better security situation in Baghdad. That was another thing that you emphasized in your piece in the LA Times.
the idea that we're not at war in Iraq is absolutely false. There is a war going on, and the reason we haven't been able to get international peacekeepers is because countries have decided that there is no peace to keep. You can't do reconstruction, and you can't have a linear, logical democratization process when the conditions of violence and insecurity that exist today are so pervasive.
Let's get another caller involved. This is Bruce, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
I think there definitely needs to be a broadening, but the broadening has to be in the international community. There's a website, www.gopbias, that stands for grandoldpartybias.com, that spells it out. We made a mistake very early on by discouraging international cooperation. We need other nations. This is a world problem, terrorism is, and we've got to have all of the minds of that part of the world and forces and policies involved in Iraq. And I think it would be a disaster if for some reason, just for Mr. Bush's reelection, we... for all practical purposes, in the world view, withdraw. It would just enforce the syndrome that is the result of Vietnam. There's a way to secure this, and that is to broaden the responsibility among the other worlds of other nations of the world. And I'm just surprised that that your gentleman there who had the article in the LA Times, of course there's a war going on, but the war can be won, and it must be won, and it must be won by the world community.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Go ahead, David Phillips.
I couldn't agree with Bruce more. You can't withdraw. There's no cut and run that can be justified. Because we're viewed as an occupier, the only way that we can change the conflict dynamics in Iraq is precisely by doing what the caller just said. You need to internationalize the reconstruction. I think one way to do that is to take the UN World Bank Monitoring Committee that was set up in advance of the Madrid Donors Conference and turn it into a full-fledged UN trust fund. And so the U.S. demonstrates a real commitment to internationalizing the reconstruction. It should match dollar for dollar from the recently approved supplemental contributions that other countries make to the trust fund.
Take some of that $87.5 billion that you're talking about.
I mean, most of that, $67 billion, was for military costs, but $20.3 was for reconstruction. That money is already a pot of money that can be drawn on. That's where you get the money to match the dollar for dollar with international contributors.
We're going to hang on with us, please, if you would, David Phillips. We're going to continue our conversation with you about the future in Iraq. We're also going to bring Colonel Anderson back into the conversation and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're also going to, ORG, not ORC. We're also going to try to bring you a read on how the Iraqi American community is responding to all of this. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about U.S. policy shifts in Iraq, militarily and politically. Our guests are David Phillips of the Council on Foreign Relations and retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Gary Anderson. And I want to ask you both about how do we deal with the security situation and move it ahead. I wanted to put it in the context of this email that we got from Ben in Ann Arbor, Michigan. If the CIA is stating that the Iraqi public is supporting the insurgents in one way or another, he writes, then doesn't that mean that escalated military against the insurgency will inevitably take on the aspects of a war against the people of Iraq themselves? Colonel Anderson?
Well, I think it's probably a mischaracterization to say that the Iraqi people are supporting the insurgents. I think if I read the newspaper reports right, they're indicating that there's a tendency in some of that swing population I referred to earlier to either be intimidated or to start moving toward the other side. And that's why I reiterate the very high importance of putting more in the way of Iraqi security forces on the street as soon as we can. I And I read David's article, and I concur that the sooner we do that is the better off we're going to be.
David Phillips' article was printed today in the Los Angeles Times. And David, get your response to that.
The problem with Iraqifying the police force is that raw recruits are being pushed out, and they're essentially being turned into cannon fodder. It's going to take a year or more before there's a new Iraqi army. I think that one way that we can have more Iraqi participation in security is to go back to the brigade-level commanders of the Iraqi army, same Iraqi army that we disbanded, ask them to reconstitute their units, go through a vetting process so that there's some kind of a screen that keeps war criminals from coming back, and use those units as a asset in site protection and border security. There are also local militias, including trustworthy ones like the Kurdish Peshmerga, that we could make much greater use of. If we had more Iraqis participating, then we could focus our force levels in hot spots like the Sunni Triangle.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Anne, who's with us from Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Yes, I've just changed my question.
Okay.
Because you're speaking to a military person. So I have been reading something recently, and I wonder if we could have this clarified. Is it true that our soldiers are being asked to actually pay for their own protective gear, something having to do with the vest they wear? And I also have another question. The other question is, because we get limited access to how Europeans are thinking in general, but what I'm thinking of, we had the very sad situation with Italians getting bombed yesterday. And these Italians, from my understanding, were in the southern part of Iraq. They were there as peacekeepers. Now, if we have other military people, that would be British, and we have Poles, we have Italians, and they're also there as peacekeepers. What happens to these people? What happens? What is the response of Europe when we see this terrible incident yesterday with Italy? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks so much.
Okay, Anne, thanks for the call. And Gary, are you aware of this?
No, that's news to me. That's untrue. I say it's untrue. Every soldier over there has his issue. Helmet, flak jacket, and so forth.
Now, the Kevlar vest.
Yeah. Now, soldiers get magazines like Soldier of Fortune and so forth that advertise, you know, better force protection equipment, and nobody's ever going to stop them from, you know, going out mail order and buying what they think is, good equipment and so forth. But no, there's nobody wandering around there in Iraq. Without a flak jacket and a helmet, that's government issue. I can't believe that.
The other point that your caller makes is important. Starting in July, the opponents to the U.S. presence changed their strategy. They started targeting U.S. allies and international organizations. Began with a suicide bombing at the Jordanian embassy. We've seen attacks against the Turkish consulate. Yesterday against not peacekeepers, but Italian gendarmerie. The UN headquarters, we know, has been bombed. So is the ICRC. One of the strategies being adopted by those who want to break our will and drive us out is to go after our allies. And it's important that the U.S. and coalition partners stay the course, but work more closely with Iraqis in governance, reconstruction, and security if this is actually going to be successful.
We just have a couple of minutes with you left, and I wanted to ask you both, given what you're seeing in terms of both military tactics and in terms of the political developments, are you at all concerned that the Bush administration may be, are you worried that there might be an attempt to get U.S. forces ramped down or start pulling them out too quickly before the situation is fully stabilized in Iraq? David Phillips?
I think that the real risk here is that if we feel political pressures, related to the upcoming election season, to rush to hand over Iraqi sovereignty, and we do so to Iraqis that have no legitimacy, or we rush to elections, the group that's best organized and is likely to be able to take power in Iraq are Islamic extremists. If the country becomes Islamicized, the Kurds, who have been good partners to date, have made it very clear that they're not going to stay a part of an Iraq that becomes an Islamic extreme republic. If they walk out, then the worst-case scenario that we envision at the outset could come true: widespread ethnic and religious violence, the country dissolving, neighboring states coming in to seize territory, the whole kit and caboodle unraveling with the U.S. right in the middle of it.
Gary Anderson?
Yeah, I let me go back to something David said earlier. I take a slight bit of exception to one of the things that is causing the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps to be a little bit slower out of the chocks than a lot of people would hope for is, in talking to my friends from Central Command, they have made a deliberate decision not to push them out too fast. They start them out with area security or point security, then they start doing assisting U.S. in coordinating and search operations. But I think they've been very mindful of not throwing them out as sort of fresh meat on the gun line. And so I disagree with that slightly, but do we want to do it faster? Yes, we do, but I agree that you can't just throw these guys out in the street and throw them to the wolves, so to speak.
And are you concerned that what you're seeing is an effort to Iraqify the military as quickly as possible and move over a provisional government as quickly as possible to accelerate an American withdrawal that might be precipitous?
I can only speak from a military standpoint. I only know what I read in the papers on the political standpoint. But as I say, I've been in fairly close contact with the Central Command folks, and I'm comfortable that they're trying to make sure that they don't rush this thing and move too quickly with it. And some would say a lot of the Iraqis, quite frankly, are saying it's not moving fast enough, and they call the Civil Defense Corps little brothers. And quite frankly, I think one of the measures of effectiveness is going to be if you start seeing the Civil Defense Corps attack like the police are, that's probably going to be an indication that they're probably being seen as more effective.
Well, we'll no doubt resume this discussion at a later date. Thank you both very much. David Phillips, Deputy Director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations, appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
He was with us from his office in New York, Colonel Gary Anderson, a former Marine, as we were instructed to say today. As always, thank you very much. Colonel Anderson was with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now from his home in Los Angeles, California, is Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini. He's an Iraqi-American and imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County. Since 9/11, we've periodically spoken with the imam to get his perspective on the Iraqi community here in the U.S. and in Iraq. And it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be with you, Neil. Thank you.
What are you hearing from your friends in Iraq about the latest developments over there?
I hear different stories from my relatives. My parents are now there. They went back to settle after 34 years. Some of my brothers at the moment are in Iraq. I have some friends, and I have some members in the governing council, some friends there. And honestly, I hear different stories. Some of them are very satisfied with the situation there, despite the setbacks, despite the problems, the security issue. They tell you that all these things, the fact that Iraq is free of Saddam Hussein, is free of dictatorship, surpasses all other problems that they are facing today. Others, of course, they tell you that we need an end to this occupation. We need Iraq to be free of the American forces here. We need a full full sovereignty for an Iraqi government in Iraq. We need a constitution to be drawn. So different views from different people.
What are some of the specific complaints you hear about?
Mostly it's about the lack of security. When people are really frustrated that the American troops there are not cooperating with the native Iraqis, with the local Iraqis, to tackle the security issue. There is lack of cooperation between the two sides. They argue that the Iraqis know their country and their people and their society better than the Americans. The Americans do not have good familiarity with the Iraqi culture, and unless we really convince the Americans to cooperate and work with the local Iraqis, we cannot put an end to this insurgency and to these attacks on the American troops and others.
It's interesting. You said the Americans aren't familiar with the Iraqi culture. A lot of people would have said they have difficulties with the language.
Not only the language, but also the customs, the tradition. You know, they don't know. In Iraq, like any other country, has a special way of showing their respect or their resentment. And maybe the American soldiers, who are very young and experienced, most of them, they are unfamiliar with these traditions, and this is what causes most of the misunderstanding between the people and the American army.
The Bush administration wants to accelerate the transfer of power to the Iraqis. The exact mechanism is not clear yet, but do you think, from what you know, that Iraq is ready for self-rule at this point?
I don't think at this moment Iraq is ready for many reasons. One of them is Saddam Hussein is still at large. Saddam Hussein sends messages to his followers and the remnants of his regime in some of the areas, especially north of Baghdad, in the city of Samarra and other cities. You would walk in the streets and you would find the message of Saddam Hussein posted on the walls. And that is really surprising. I mean, these things happen while the American soldiers are walking on the ground. So I don't think this is a good idea. Iraq still does not have a policing force. Iraq does not have an intelligence force there. Iraq is open for the foreign terrorists who are infiltrating the country almost on daily basis. The frontiers of Iraq are open. I don't think it's a good idea that the full sovereignty is transferred to an Iraqi government, which has little power to tackle all these issues.
We just have a few seconds left, but obviously we're talking mostly about Baghdad and the so-called Sunni triangle north and west of that city, which is a big part of the country, a very important part of the country. But how widespread are these difficulties? Are you hearing same complaints all over the country?
Yes, I think it's very, it is spreading and deteriorating day by day. And one of the reasons, because the Americans are not using some of the important tactics. I think, for instance, they have to seal this this area and start searching homes, house by house, because many of those people, they have mortar, you know, they have weapons, they have grenades, they have missiles there, and unless we go house by house, we really cannot put an end to this miserable, you know, situation there.
Imam Al-Qazwini, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
Imam Syed Mustafa Al-Qazwini is an Iraqi-American imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County, and he spoke with us from his home in Los Angeles. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.